Hi, friends. Just to make sure that everyone's clear, Scott Hunter, my boss, is not checking his email. He's trying to get fast passes, and it's okay for him to do that. So if you see anyone on their phones, I'm checking my blood sugar. That's my excuse, and that's a true story. And he's checking his fast pass, and then any of these three are doing email, probably. Okay, cool. All right, so this is a little panel that we do every Dev Intersection. We have all kinds of fun with it. It's called Hanselman and Friends. And right now we've got a lovely group of guests here. To my right, Javier Lozano out of Des Moines, beautiful Des Moines, and one of my cohorts on .NET Conf. We've did .NET Conf and Azure Conf and ASP Conf for years now, having all kinds of fun. Great community person. We got Jen Looper. You may have heard her on my podcast talking about native script. She works at Progress Software. My wonderful friend Kathleen Dollard, basically expert in all things curly brace, every curly brace related language she knows, backwards and forwards, C, C++.
A little VB too.
A little VB too, a longtime VB person. And then my boss, and he has to be here because he's my boss, Scott Hunter. Scott Hunter, no, I'm just teasing. Everyone, Scott Hunter have our whole frenemies thing, and people come on off and they go, oh my God, you were so mean to your boss. It's just a joke.
Happens every day, though.
And it does happen. It does happen every day.
Actually, both ways. Not
never not funny. Never not funny.
You know it's review time.
Yes, and we appreciate you not wearing a red shirt to try to make people think that you're one of the greater Scots. We are the lesser Scots. Or also referred to as Scots the Lesser, like attorneys general. Yes.
At this show, people just come by and say, oh, it's the Scots.
The Scots, yeah, we're just the collective. Cool. All right, so we only have three microphones, so try to talk clearly and closely and share your microphones with folks. So we do this panel and we talk about kind of trends and the way that we think things are going. One of the things that I'm having right now is a little bit of JavaScript fatigue. JavaScript is eating the world, and I keep seeing I need 5 years experience in Angular, and I'm pretty sure it hasn't been out for 5 years. Javier, are you seeing this as a problem, or is it just me and my lack of ability in JavaScript?
No, I've seen that a lot, actually. It seems to be that as a developer community, we're always going after the next hot thing. So whenever a new JavaScript framework comes out, we sort of create this vibe within ourselves that, hey, we got to learn this specific thing, now we got to do this, we got to learn these different things. And when you say, like, those 5 years of JavaScript, it's like, yeah, oh, sorry, of Angular, people expect that because we build it onto ourselves. There's always something, you know, there's a new framework every year, and I barely keep up trying to learn Angular 2, and there's a 4 now.
There's Angular 4?
There's Angular 4.
When did that happen?
They had, like... It happened like...
Are you serious?
Yeah, like last month. Yeah,
they
renamed it. Yeah.
And we skipped 3.
We skipped... It was so hot, bypassed movie theaters and went to video.
Jen, this is the freaking thing. We skip Windows 9, people go insane. Google skips Angular 3, and it's like, whee! Everyone
you have to
no one has
router.
A problem with that.
Blame the router.
Yeah. And Chrome is like on 99 now.
Yeah, something
like that. As we're speaking, Chrome is updating. So... Jen, how can I get past JavaScript fatigue?
So I have another word for it, and I call it job security. So, okay, so Angular 2 comes out, Angular 4. Well, you probably want to know a little bit of React so that you can talk to the cute guys over there. That's awesome. But what about Vue.js? This is really interesting to learn. Well, the problem is that all of these frameworks are trying to solve the same thing. So I think that, you know, if you are great at learning things and you're interested in learning new things, then just keep learning the frameworks. Why not?
So you don't think that this is a big deal to have to go and learn new frameworks? Because I get emails from people who they'll give me a list of frameworks, and then they will say, like, I need to pick 2. I don't know why they always pick a number. Mm. And they're basically saying, I only have enough brain cells to understand these 2. You're saying, learn them all, have fun, job security.
I think so, in my opinion. Just go ahead and keep learning. Always keep learning. If I don't learn one new thing every day, then that's a wasted day.
Well, you can definitely learn one new JavaScript framework every day.
Absolutely. And then throw it away.
What do you think, Kathleen?
Well, I just kind of skip it all myself and play on the back end because it's just so much safer feeling. I did spend some time in Node, and that was interesting. And I got a light note for a couple of things, but large-scale frameworks doesn't happen to be one of them.
Mm.
Mostly, actually, because not only do we have a bunch of JavaScript frameworks, we also have boatloads of supporting stuff coming out all the time. And I have actually seen a Node application that had 900 items in its NPM packages.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, everyone complains about Windows not supporting long paths, right? And they've been saying, well, when is Windows going to have long paths? It's like, well, Node started it. No one noticed before.
Yeah.
Before Node modules, no one said a boo to me about Windows long paths.
Yeah, so I think it's great that open source does provide so much interesting things. And I think it's sort of a time we're in where we are scrolling through so much and trying to find our legs as to what actually makes sense in terms of whether we have an entire JavaScript package to do a left pad, or whether we have something else, or whether we find ways to rely on a person, ultimately, because there's a lot of credibility and respect in this area, mm-hmm. to have something that is a group together, this works together kind of thing, in somewhat larger chunks. And I think it's going to be a natural evolution. Pendulum swing in this industry. I've been here a very long time, and right now we're swinging over to that one-line micro package, which is perhaps not a good idea, and it'll turn back to someplace a little saner. So I guess that's the other thing, is that when we get really crazy in this industry, having watched it for several decades, almost three decades, then when we get crazy about something, we generally kind of get back to center. So right now, JavaScript frameworks are crazy. They'll settle out. They're not as crazy as they were a couple of years ago, I don't think.
Mm-hmm.
They're moving fast, but so there's only a few we care about.
You bring up a really interesting point. So to kind of balance out the, yes, there's a new framework, Angular and Angular 2 and Angular 4, or keep always learning, you're pointing out that there are the big giant frameworks, the opinionated frameworks, where it's like Angular, like it's the way that you write, it's the prescription for JavaScript applications. And then on the other side, you've got these little one and two line kind of utility packages. And if you do that wrong, you're going to end up with this huge dependency chain.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
And you know what? It's going to work great for V1. It'll be awesome.
I don't think I've ever actually made a Node app without a warning about some version, because anything that you restore today is going to get updated tomorrow.
Yeah.
So, Scott Hunter, it seems like Microsoft has gotten out of the business of prescribing which JavaScript. Sometimes people come and say, tell us what the new Microsoft SPA framework is going to be.
Well, I was going to make fun of us first. I was going to say we went through the same phase as well with .NET. If you remember, we actually renamed Windows Server to Windows Server.NET.
Did we do that?
Back in 2002.
I don't think I was around then.
We actually renamed the
Windows Server.
We made every product .NET. So Windows Server.NET, and the funny thing about that was there was no .NET in Windows Server. We named the product Windows Server.NET, and you had to go download and install .NET on.
Now you're going to make me go off on our whole top level domain thing. Like it ruined my whole .org strategy.
So I want to take a different angle than everybody else took on this. Not only is, you see these client-side frameworks, Angular, React, and so on, that have this huge explosion of popularity. And I'm looking at a whole room full of developers, so I'm going to blame some of you guys. I've also seen the over-spa-fication of the web. So who in the room goes to a website today, and it loads, it's empty, and then stuff starts going ding, 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 because everybody thinks that we have to go make every application full of spa-fication.
Spa-ification.
And so what I would challenge people is all these frameworks that are coming out, they're awesome. Use them when they need to be used, not just everywhere. So I'll give you a great example. My bank, I'm not going to name them, they had this great web page for paying my bills. It listed all the people down the left side, and I put in values on the right side and selected dates.
I know that bank.
And they decided to go spa-fy that application. So now I have to click each one individually. A window pops up. I can select the date and type the number in. What was the value? I could do all my bills at once before.
Well, when did the table tag become a dirty word?
Exactly.
If it's a table of data, it should probably use a table.
So my point is
heresy. True heresy.
True heresy. my point is just
someone's tweeting that. He said table was okay.
So some developer wanted the new shiny thing, and they threw the new shiny thing in the app for my bank.
Right.
And I was punished for it. So.
And he's not bitter, really.
But I see it. Even Richard Campbell, who puts on this show with Shirley, he was telling me that even on the .NET Rock site, they went down this same path where they over-spa-ified their site as well. And so it just loaded really slow and stuff kind of paged in and stuff like that. And so my point to folks is, as developers, we love new tech and we should learn it, but figure out where you need to use it. Don't just use it everywhere.
Right. So a while back, I wrote a blog post that was called If I Was Starting All Over. It was actually in 2014. And I said that people always say, what should I do if I'm starting all over or I'm just getting started? I said you should learn JavaScript, HTML, and then some server language, some back-end language. That back-end language might be Node, but it could be Erlang, it could be C#, it could be whatever. But I said that you definitely need to know some JavaScript. And then people usually say, oh, well, you mean like jQuery? I'm like, well, no. jQuery is an automatic shift car. I want you to learn how to drive a clutch first, and then you can get the good stuff. Do you think that people should learn that way? Like, I know that we are of a certain age that we might think that we shouldn't give the kids garbage collection to start with. We make them suffer with like malloc and free, and then we give them garbage collection. Or is it okay to start them with a high level language on the back end? Do you think that it's valid to say learn JavaScript and a server language? You said the back end is where you like to play, Kathleen.
Yeah, I think it kind of depends on what you like to do, because if you just want to make HTML pages with a button on it that goes and does something interesting on the back end, that's great. I'm also going to say that one of the most awesome learning tools available today is Unity.
Yeah, Unity.
There's some great tools that are not, they must have gotten their fast pass. All right.
He's
Come on,
excited.
You guys are happy for them. You're happy for them, okay?
He's very excited about his fast pass.
Yeah, I guess I don't feel like it has to be JavaScript. I think Ruby's a good first language. I think C# can be. I think Unity can be.
I thought I need to have full stack on my resume to get a job.
Okay, if somebody puts full stack on a resume that crosses my desk, they better
Has full stack on their resume,
I will probably
even
not
though they
call
don't
you.
Have the full stack.
I will probably not call you because
really?
I don't believe anybody today can
But
be
I'm a certified Microsoft certified professional. Don't I need that too? So you don't think full stack's important?
To me, I want somebody good at what they do, and when they work, if they're working for me, and I do lead I'm the director of engineering for a software company, then if they're working for me, then I'm going to focus them on the front end or the back end. I'm not going to tell somebody, I've got one full stack developer, and he's very valuable to us because he's not our best front end and he's not our best back end. Mm. He's the one guy who goes across both, and I need one person doing that, and he's actually really, really sharp and does a decent job across. But I'd never have him learn a second front-end framework.
Let me add to that. I mean, I see the same thing. We go see a lot of customers as part of my job.
Sure.
And almost always I see front-end people and back-end people. How many people know Angular and can write store procedures for SQL databases?
I used to back in the day. I don't think I could do it anymore.
But the reality, you typically find experts in SQL and databases,
very specific,
and you find experts
in
front end. And maybe if you're in a smaller company and you don't have a lot of staff, maybe you have to do all of it. But in the bigger companies that I see, there's a clean separation.
Okay. What do you think, Javier?
Well, it's interesting because I always say, I used to say this in regards to with an architect, it's like sometimes you have to be a mile wide and an inch deep. But you have to know when to switch to be a mile deep and an inch wide. So you have to know a little bit about everything at a high level, maybe to be able to focus on specific things. And I think that's becoming true for all developers now, right? And you're talking about, you know, whether I'm front end or back end, middleware now, because that's the thing now.
So a little familiarity with all things.
So a little familiarity doesn't mean I know Angular. I'm not an expert at Angular. I know a lot of people who are experts in Angular, so I can always pick up the bat phone and say, hey.
I only know John Papa.
Well, it's a good first step.
It is a good first step. What do you think, Jen?
Well, it's a very interesting question, but I think that learning JavaScript is very valid. And what's interesting is I'm not sure I'm seeing that in kids coming out of boot camps nowadays. At least in Boston, we have an awful lot of people learning Rails. That's what they do in their boot camps. And they're asking me for professional advice, and I'm like, I don't know, because I'm not so sure.
Well, that brings up a really interesting point. So Maria on my team, her job is to get people in boot camps looking at .NET because we think it's a language that lets you write Apple Watch apps and giant cloud apps and everything in between. But she says everyone's teaching Rails. Rails is super opinionated because Rails is not Ruby. Yeah, but there's not a lot of Rails jobs out there.
That's true. There's a boot camp that my son went to that I am very intimately aware of their curriculum. And to take people from never writing a line of code to being extremely workable developers, they're ready to go. They know Git. They know how to do things. They've fallen on their face in Go because they can also play on the sides. Okay. It's totally awesome. And so I do think
they're
Rails,
teaching them Rails?
Yeah, Ruby on Rails, yeah. Now, they've also just about got the maxed out Ruby. You know, if you want a Ruby developer in Denver, then, you know, you can get that. But if anybody wants someone someplace else, just touch base with me, and I can tell you more. But I think Ruby is a good first language. Rails is a good first tool, as long as you don't just start right there. So if you start with Ruby, and you write your own ORM, and you're doing your own stuff, and you're going, oh, it's painful, and they say, well, now we'll show you Rails, then that's a learning process that a good pedagogy is going to walk somebody through that on any language that's out there. It doesn't, you know, whatever it is.
Yeah.
And I think it is all about pedagogy, and I think we're maturing our pedagogy as we go along.
Maybe you could also define pedagogy for those of us who went to community college.
I've been teaching in classrooms for a long time. It's the science and the method of teaching. Mm-hmm. So how do you teach, and especially how are you teaching kids versus how are you teaching adult learners? That's a different beast, entirely different conversation. Mm-hmm. But I think the boot camps are also, and I hope this is happening, teaching people how to think like a programmer, not just learn this or that language. So my niece got a creative writing degree from Brown. And that was a little on the hungry side. So she went to a boot camp in New York City. I can't remember the name of it, but she is now a data scientist. So I think she had, you know, she was able to learn. She was able to learn new things, and I think they're teaching kids how to think like a programmer, not so much, you know, become a JavaScript developer.
So that brings up a really interesting question, right? There's a lot of people out there who have varying and sundry degrees from varying places, myself included. I know that you have a very advanced degree. You have a PhD. In a very useful topic for programming. What is your PhD in?
Well, my PhD is in medieval French, so if you have any questions about 13th century prose,
so not just
I'm
French, but medieval French.
Old French, yes.
So there's like when you watch a movie or whatever and King Arthur talks to the French, you can't even watch it. It's like, it's garbage. But ultimately, though, a degree like that teaches you how to think, and that's what I'm hearing you say.
More or less, yeah.
Now, Javier, what is your degree in?
So my degree is in computer science.
So this is interesting because my degree is not in computer science. Yep. It's in software engineering. And I think there's a big difference between the two. Do you?
Oh, yeah, there is. So the one thing I always keep telling people is that as a computer scientist, quote unquote, is that I was taught the science of computing. Here's the theory. Here's all the discrete mathematics. Here's why big O exists. All these different things. So we had to prove regular expressions. I couldn't write one.
Like prove what about them? That they're hard?
Prove that they're viable, that a computer could process them. Oh, I couldn't write one in Perl, I couldn't write one in C# or anything else, but I knew the math and the science behind a regular expression. So that was the thing that I would say differentiates computer engineering, that's making things, compared to science. Hey, I proved that this thing can exist. So
interesting.
Because
when I learned software engineering, we learned TDD and testing first, and this was 20 plus years ago. We were doing continuous integration and continuous deployment before it was a buzzword, and now here we are in 2017 trying to convince companies that that's a good thing. But when I was learning the practice of software, I didn't learn any of the discrete math, right? Everything's a for loop as far as I'm concerned. Even better if it's nested like four deep.
Like in a giant TD.
Because it looks like an arrow at that point.
You didn't learn relational algebra?
What's that?
You didn't learn relational algebra?
What kind of algebra?
Relational.
No, I didn't. I don't know what that is.
That's the algebra that defines SQL.
Defines who?
SQL.
SQL. Yeah.
No, I didn't learn that. I know what a left join is,
behind SQL expressions.
Yeah. Some tuple calculus as well?
Yeah. Oh, now the computer science people are geeking out now. That's great.
I don't feel
excluded at all.
Are there any other scientists out there? Hard science, chemists, physicists?
Yeah, where are our chemists and physicists? Where's our people?
Are the only one? No.
Are there any humanities
Everybody
people
here?
Humanities.
Down there,
humanities, yes.
Are you kidding?
So you're not going to get solidarity that way, Kathleen. Community college people. Woo! See?
So, actually, I got an interesting
question.
They're on
my side.
How many musicians out there? How many guys have actually a music degree or doing any of that?
Music degree. Ooh, there we go. That's good numbers. See, this is the thing. Getting through school is about playing the game, about showing up on time, about putting the homework in, about learning how to think, about now my new word, pedagogy, of it, like thinking about how I learn, knowing how you learn, and trying to adjust that with how the teacher learns. But I'm hearing we should teach kids how to code. And we teach a fourth grader Scratch, and then now they can work at Google. That is the direct, straight, like that's the straight line, right?
It's the only way to get to Google.
But you have to learn Scratch as a fourth grader?
You have to learn Scratch to get there, but you got to do it and go.
No one told me this. I'm so annoyed.
Darn my medieval French degree.
I think my son wants a job at Google, so I have to let him know that.
Yeah,
he's only got a
Scratch. It's all about Scratch.
Scratch and Python, right?
One of my most popular podcasts was with a woman named Keisha Rogers, where she said, we shouldn't teach kids how to code. We should teach them how to think.
Yep.
And I'm hearing that in underneath what you're saying. She says specifically systems thinking.
So it's really interesting to watch the evolution. My daughter just went through, I have two daughters that are just finishing up in high school. I sent one away, working on the other one. And the first one took AP Comp Sci, and it was using UMass's Java curriculum. It was literally the worst thing I've ever seen in my life. It was, I'm sorry if anybody worked on that. I had so much trouble with it, but I'm sitting there trying to help her debug. What a nightmare. But and now my second daughter's going through AP Comp Sci, and it's systems thinking. They've completely changed the curriculum. So,
really? Okay,
I think
so what does that
good.
Look like? How do you teach systems thinking?
I haven't seen the curriculum, but I think it's about solving problems and helping other people, because millennials learn very collaboratively, and they work together to solve problems. I think it's great for them.
Yeah. One of the things that I'm trying to do, because I have young boys, 9 and 11, is for them to think about how things fit into the world, how they fit into the larger world. But I always use the toaster example, where the toaster's broken. Right, and you can unplug the toaster and look at the toaster as if it is a function, right? It insert bread, output toast, but you plug the thing in and it doesn't work. Well, people don't think about the larger system. We literally had a toaster crisis at the house recently, and we went all the way back to the fuse box, thinking maybe the fuse had gone, but it was actually the GFI, the ground fault interrupter, on one of the other plugs. So you got the outlet over here; it's that outlet that's pissing this one off. Right? So then it turned into this really interesting conversation with my sons where it was like, hey guys, just because you flip this light switch and that light turns on doesn't mean that they even know each other. It could be a coincidence that you flipped the light on and that turned on at the same time. And that got them to think about systems thinking. Do you think I'm raising my children okay? Kathleen.
I'm not sure I'm the one to ask, because kids grow up and some of them like rebel with like sex, drugs, and rock and roll. And my kids, man, they grew up and they rebelled with Linux and C++. And
oh, no!
Even Haskell.
Haskell, no!
And Ruby. I was
That's
in
a pretty
too.
Cool rebellion, though. I appreciate that kind of rebellion. Is that systems thinking, that lengthy story about the toaster?
I think it is, and if it isn't, at least they'll know how to fix the electrical. So well, that's money. So
thank
money.
You for that.
I was going to say, so back to the computer science thing, because like, that was the one thing I really loved about my degree, was that we were taught to learn and how to figure out how we make those connections. Because when you're sitting there trying to figure out a proof or something, there's no one else helping you. You have to make sure that you connect the dots, you understand the concepts, and apply it to it. So whatever language you learn, you know the basics, at least, of how to go about it.
So how important is some of the historical context that happens? Like, I was teaching someone on my team some things about C# and IL, so I started teaching the only way I knew how, which is from the metal, where the metal is like, look at these opcodes, that's so cool. Turns out it's not cool at all. The person on my team said that they didn't learn from the metal up. They learn from the screen, the glass of the monitor, back.
That's where your pedagogy is coming in, because you have
That's
to
pedagogy
you have to tailor the way you teach to
Seriously.
The way your learners learn. Like, I'm
so
a very visual learner. I would be so lost.
Yeah, so I was trying to teach .NET, and I was talking about how it turns into IL and yada, yada, yada. They said, no, make me a web API, go into Chrome, hit F11, and then let's go through the screen and go back down. It sounds like it's a silly thing to say, but it is a very valid thing. So you should be asking yourselves, how do you think? And I think sometimes it's an age thing, where people who came up at a certain time, you don't think so, okay? Argue with me.
No, I absolutely don't think it's an age thing. If you think about people and how much different they are, one way to think about them is if you think about like what happens in a geology picture, where you like take a slice of some piece of land and it looks different. If you take a different slice, it looks different. And there's all sorts of different ways to think about how people think. but how people work and how they are. But one of them is that there's some very, very clear differences in the way people take in information and process it. And for some people, neither of what you just said would be the best way to learn C sharp. A better way to learn C sharp would be to draw a picture about what's happening and work at it from a completely different direction. And I'm one of those people. I am so visual that in graduate school when I was taking high-end chemistry, I took notes that I then gave to other people and never used myself.
I wish I could be those people
that,
like,
draw things.
You know the people who draw the little cartoons in the middle of it? What is that called? Sketchnoting or whatever? Yep. Is anyone sketchnoting this? That would be insane to see. I'd like to see that.
There is a lost thing here, though. I mean, if you just learn the way you just described before.
Yeah.
Who in here knows what a garbage collector is?
Well, we know what it is. Like, I know how to say it and spell it.
I think there's also some of that stuff is important.
Yeah.
People need to know that when you allocate memory, that it, how does it go away?
Well, it gets garbage collected.
And exactly, but when and why and what does it do to your application?
Occasionally and when you need it.
So I was going to say some of that system stuff is still important for people to actually understand
right.
more than
but
just the language.
But this gets to the what do you need to know, what should you know, what would be nice to know, what's trivia. Yeah. Like I always read the Stack Overflow blog, and I always think that I'm a crappy engineer, and I hate myself, and I don't know anything, and imposter syndrome, and it's a spiral of despair. But then I realize that I don't work at Stack Overflow, and I don't have to optimize things that way, so I'm not that person. And I just accept that that's not a piece of knowledge that I need to necessarily have.
I'll give you a funny piece of trivia, and not try to throw somebody under the bus in the process.
Oh.
A couple years, there was a launch that we were doing at Microsoft, and we had all recorded a bunch of videos and stuff like that, and they built this beautiful website for it, and the website lasted 13 seconds.
13 seconds.
Nobody had ever thought of what happens if 1,000 people hit the website. Or 10,000 people, or 100,000 people at the website. And so the website, because nobody ever looked at it that way, they put all this social networking goop in it, all this video stuff in it, and it maxed out at 10 users. And so...
Was it the right 10 users, though?
Everybody approved it and was like, yeah, this is awesome.
Yeah.
And 13 seconds into the product launch, the website was removed.
So what's the moral?
I have a moral, which is wherever you come from, there's some spaces that you just have to get to. I teach the garbage collector, but I'm a visual and screen back, but mostly big picture, I got to look at the whole thing kind of person. But I actually teach teach garbage collection, not tomorrow's workshop, sorry, but in other workshops. And you've got to get to scalability, and you have to have some concept of allocations.
Okay. But does everyone
and there are
here,
things that you do have to get to.
Does everyone here have to have deep understanding about multiple generations and know what each generation does in the garbage collector?
No.
I'm just writing for loops and putting them in a text box.
No, they just need to know that there is a garbage collector and what it does and how it does what it does.
And so that maybe, gets to the need to know versus would be nice to know.
And maybe the simple thing, because you can all take it home, which is in a perfect world, every single thing you put on the heap either goes away very, very quickly or stays forever, and that's all there is, because then garbage collection doesn't actually happen.
Right.
That's interesting.
The problem,
how it happens, not so much.
But Kathleen, let's be real, though. There are people who don't know what the heap is who have been programming for 20 years. There are people who have never looked at the call stack window in Visual Studio. I've met developers working at large enterprises that have never set a breakpoint. They just do got here debugging. Got here. It must be between those two got here's. This is people with 20 years experience, but it's the same year 20 times.
Oh, that's very
these people
true.
Exist,
yeah.
Kathleen.
I'm crying.
So my point is, though, that like, what do you need to know to be a successful programmer? You know, the heap, the stack, those are computer science concepts. You know, Hunter's saying you got to know garbage collection. Jen, what do you think?
Or you have to have somebody in your team that knows it. I mean, it doesn't have to be that you know
or
everything.
I just call John Papa.
You need some John Papas and some old folks.
That's actually a great point, though. If you know someone who can help you, it's always find the helpers. Just like Mr. Rogers says, find the helpers and then learn from them. I mean, we're like
yes,
my friend Tracy Lee is constantly
go.
Pairing
now
with people. And you can't know everything. I'm not even quite sure about the heap, but I'm not a .NET developer. Is that okay?
It is okay. You're JavaScript developer.
Well, thank God, because
which is
you know.
Good.
But I would. And now I know who to talk to. I'll talk to you.
We appreciate JavaScript and native script developers.
So actually, that's the most important skill. Is you know, on top of the stuff we talked about before, I mean, if we look at Microsoft, the thing I look for, somebody that has a resume and comes and interviews with us, can you find information? I mean, that's the most important thing for us to teach our kids and all of our programmers is, you know, I have friends that ask me a question, hey, can this work on this? I Google it and read the result back to them. I'm like, why did you not do that?
So I got in trouble. True story, and my wife is still on a plane, so I can tell it. I got in trouble a couple of days ago because my dad called and he wanted to know, what did he want to know? He was trying to ask me whether Windows Defender scanned the spam folder in his Gmail. You know, and it was a great question. It's like an adorable question, but it was just like, do you just say, yes? Right? Yes, Windows Defender totally scans the Gmail spam folder. You're good. Or do you start to say, well, the heap. You know what I'm saying? Like, and my wife said that I was very crisp with my dad because I was, you know, it's non-technical parent. So it gets me a little confused. That, like, what level do you stop and you say, I accept this level of abstraction and I don't go any farther. Like, I always feel like you should teach people these things and then they can selectively choose to forget them. Like, I know how to change my oil. I did it once. And now I hire someone to change my oil. Is that a reasonable solution?
I think it is. Actually, the interesting thing that I was going to mention with all this that kind of ties the pieces together is some of the stuff that we built the virtual conferences with .NET Conf and everything mm-hmm. else, is that to me is about paying it forward. Like a good example of this, when I first started school, I knew Visual Basic. I was programming in Visual Basic 4, 5, 6, Windows 3.1, all that awesome stuff. I had to learn C++ for introductory programming languages in computer science, which is C++. For learning that way, it's ridiculous. So I found a tutor, another fellow CompSci, and I learned it well. And I was like, thank you so much. How can I repay it? And he looks at me and he's like, teach others. So what I would do, I started volunteering, I started teaching other students and so forth, and that was the whole mentality of paying it forward. Because someone's gonna pay it forward to you in another way, because you're bringing that knowledge to them. So that's a big thing, is whatever you're learning, however you wanna learn it, is always about giving something up so that way the entire community and everybody else benefits from it.
That is a really good reminder to all of us in all of our interactions. I always say, don't give bile a permalink. If I can go, if you're interviewing and I can go in Google or Google with Bing for something and I find a link, a URL that points to you being a jerk, then that's problematic. You know what I mean? Whether that be a Twitter tweet to someone or a mean comment or whatever, if there's a pattern of those kind of things. So I never be mean and then give it a link. If you're going to be mean, do it in person.
And just to add to that, when somebody comes to you with a problem, wouldn't you love to learn the solution to that problem while it's their problem and not your problem? Mm. And so it also keeps you a little ahead of the curve on the kind of common problems that comes up when you do help people out on their problem before you're faced with a similar problem.
Right. And I always encourage everyone to write these things down. The way that I kind of became a blogger was anytime anything happened that was interesting, I would blog about it. I wasn't blogging for you all. I'm blogging for me. So I can go and Google it later. Because what happens is the loneliest feeling on the internet is when you Google for a problem and then you find yourself asking that question like a year ago and no answers. You know, so I hate hearing from people that they solved a problem and then they never told anyone about it. Write it down, put it on Stack Overflow. Let's go and do this. I'm going to go out into the audience and we'll do some questions and some Q&A and we'll find out the limitations of these microphones and whether or not they decide to do some feedback loop or something.
I thought he was going to say, find out the limitations of the panel.
Any questions for our panel? Hands up, anyone who's got any comments or questions? You all just asleep? What's going on? What's wrong with you people? I'm coming all the way out here in the back. I feel like Donahue. See, now I've just aged myself because all the 25-year-olds are like, who's Donahue? Maybe he means Maury Povich. Not a single question from these people for these people. I'll fooey on you all as a group.
Back there, Scott.
Here's a question here from Batman.
Hi. So we have spoken a lot about cloud and moving to cloud and everything. So there are a lot of industries which are like still kind of skeptical towards not moving to cloud and everything. So what are your thoughts and feelings about that?
That's a great question. There's a whole bunch of people out there moving to the cloud, but there's a bunch of other people who are feeling like maybe the cloud's too, you're not really ready to go, and they have trust issues with the cloud. How do we get people to move to the cloud, and do we in fact want them to do that? You're all just looking at each other.
I can take a stab at it. Funny enough, I used my old previous job. I was that person in the organization. I was the head of IT architecture, trying to get us to the cloud. So my thing with it is just someone else's server, right?
Don't look at me, man.
The difference is you can't control it.
Don't ever look at me. I'm not interesting.
What am I doing?
Sorry, not you, brother. I'm telling my cameraman friend that the interesting stuff's on stage.
So the big thing here is for them to try to get and understand what problem are you trying to solve, and is the cloud the right solution for it? Is co-location the right solution for it? You have to get down to that level and actually figure out why there is that mistrust, right? It's really not a technology problem. It's usually some sort of discomfort that I don't know enough about this, and it's because I don't know enough about it, I don't want to let you know that, and because of that, you may think I'm dumb. So a lot of our conversations that we had wasn't technology-based, was more of like, how can this be more better? Like, how can this be good for the company? Kind of like in office space. That's essentially what we're trying to do. We're trying to get down to that core answer of how we move forward.
It's interesting and cool. Sorry, Kathleen, that Javier touched on that idea of imposter syndrome, even coming into business decisions.
Yep.
I know lots of people. I've even seen research from Forrester that said that 70% of people are basically lying about knowing about the cloud, because they're afraid that if they don't look like they know about the cloud, that they're going to not be competitive anymore. We need to be a little more open about that and what we do understand and what we don't, so we can ask the right questions. Kathleen, do you have a comment?
Well, I was just going to say that, I mean, I do think that there's an element to say, well, maybe you don't need to go to the cloud. I mean, we have working infrastructure in-house, and right now we're going to stay there for a little while because everything's smooth enough, and sure, there's a few things we might come up with in the future that need some scaling and all, but right now we're just kind of rocking on existing infrastructure and don't act, even though it needs some updating, we don't see a big reason to make that shift right now.
That's a good point. I see a lot of people talking about moving to the cloud, but they don't have a continuous integration system internally. Like, if you have to open up two Explorer windows and then copy your stuff into production, maybe there's a maturity issue there as an organization, and moving to the cloud isn't appropriate.
We do have CI, though.
No, I'm not talking about you. Yeah. I know that your stuff is tight. I'm just saying, like, for other people, I've seen folks that have a deployment that is manual. I've seen deployments that involve faxing managers for approval. Maybe get your fax situation on lock before you move to the cloud. You have a question right here.
So one of the big problems for a lot of corporations is the pace of innovation. Things are moving way too fast. You got people who still are looking for SP1s before they'll even think of looking at a product that's just came out. How do we convince corporations to even invest in new technologies? I'll give you an example, .NET Core. I'm working on a private thing right now. We started working on 1.0, and 2.0 is coming out. So the next conversation we have when I come back is, do we wait? Do we start now? Do we keep going? How do we keep this pace where it used to be a few years that you could work on something and then all of a sudden you didn't have to worry about a new version until you've got a 2.0 coming out?
I was just going to add, kind of chip in with my experience at Progress. We actually have an internal incubator, and we are incubating, for our focus right now is on machine learning. So we have a group in Bulgaria who's working on some amazing new machine learnable bots or some such thing. They're incubating this new stuff. Maybe it'll be adopted, maybe it won't be, but if you have the space within your org to incubate new ideas and to test and to try and to let internal people see how well they work, that could be a strategy to try.
Yeah, I worked at companies with an R&D department. You have to be about 300 or 400 people before you could have 5 or 10 doing R&D. Smaller companies can struggle with that, but an R&D department definitely helps. Scott Hunter, you own .NET.
Thanks, Scott. I think there's a couple ways I look at this. Is first off, when we did .NET Core, we came up with two models of being able to take up .NET Core. One we call LTS, which is long-term support, and one we call FTS, which is kind of current. And the long-term support is actually to kind of address what you're talking about. You can build an app on .NET Core 1 today, and you're going to get support for X number of years, even if we do a 1.1 or a 1.2 or a 1.3. And so that's what we're trying to do as a company to try to help that, is say, hey, we're going to have a version of 1.0 that stays around for a long time, and you can stick on that. And so a 1.0 investment is not bad. And the other thing, which I think is the more important thing for .NET, is we make sure now that you can actually side-by-side install all of our .NETs, all of our .NET cores. So you can actually have one project on 1.0 and have another project on 2.0 on the same box, and they don't bleed into each other and they don't mess up your application. So you're not going to have this problem that you might have had with .NET Framework in the past, where somebody in the team goes, hey, I need to use async await, so I need 4.5, and we put 4.5 on it, it breaks five other applications. So we're trying to change the technology to solve those types of problems.
Got a follow-up question?
Well, the other issue with that is that you end up developing, specifically with like .NET Core, you end up developing around things that are not there ready for you when you started doing 1.0. So you started working on things that are moving you towards what you need to do, but now 2.0's got something and you're like, oh, that solved my problem. I don't need a code around it. So you have to go back and make that decision of which one you're going to actually pick. And that's moving so fast that you never start really getting going.
One of the things that I encourage people to do is, and I'm not being facetious here, is don't get all wrapped up in the daily builds of our thing. We have a community stand-up every Tuesday. We have Twitter. If you watch those things and you are working for the government, it's legit going to stress you out, right? So don't watch those things. And I'm being totally serious. Don't try to look at our commits, because it's just going to make you feel bad about the long-term support. Like, I know that there's a new version of Ubuntu every couple of weeks, and there's another great version every 6 months, but the LTS version comes out in April, like clockwork, and it's supported for 3 years. That's why it's long-term support. So I think to the point is that, and also another point is organizational maturity. You're saying that you may have to go back and then refactor something. Sometimes it's refactoring via subtraction. If you have good test coverage and CI/CD, that's not a big deal. If you are afraid to do that, maybe it's not .NET Core you're afraid of. Maybe it's your code and the infrastructure around it. Not necessarily meaning you, but you know, the set of all people who are not me.
But there's always going to be a newer thing that's better. That's kind of just the world we live in today. I mean, all frameworks are going to
move. It moves fast. Like with Angular 4 came out in the middle of this talk.
Right. You just have to commit at some point and think about 2.0 after you finish your project.
I think that's absolutely true, but I mean, there is the flippant answer is, do you actually want it to go slower? And the answer is probably no, don't want it to go slower. We like that fast pace. We like the new stuff. It's great stuff that's happening. The question is really, how on earth do we uptake it and move through that? And there's no question that it's been a difficult couple of years around the Microsoft space. .NET Core has been, coming, and it's been a ride. And Angular has been changing, and lots of changing. So you do have to pick those points, because those are the points for major apps that you're going to be committing to have that expertise in-house for a long time. And to me, there's the investment in your code, and that's not trivial. I don't mean to trivialize it. But you're also putting a stake in the sand. So how many of you also support web forms right now? Also? Okay, maybe a third of you to a half of you. So you have some expertise in web forms right now in-house. If you're doing MVC3, you have some expertise in MVC3 in the house, or you're in trouble. So when you make that stake in the sand, I think thinking about it not only of where your code is, but where your people are going to be. So on the 1.0 app, one of the things I think about on that and talk to managers about is, where do we want those stakes in the sand to be 3 years from now? So where in this line do we want a stake in the sand? And it might not be 1.0. It might be 2.0 or 2.1 or someplace a little further down. So just kind of fake it till you get there, but then stick a stake in the sand and say, this is where we're going to be on this app for a while, because your investment in people is way bigger than your investment in the code.
Very good advice. Question right here.
This is kind of a multi-part question. So when you have a large developer group with a wide spread of, we'll call it, talent and passion, what are some of the things that you could recommend or things that you would do to help motivate those that don't have that passion but are in the job, or those that have the passion but are finding it difficult to reach that next level?
So I can take a stab. That's a great, that's an excellent question.
Yeah, that was a clap-worthy question right there.
Yeah. Honestly, I think a lot of you may have the same situation across organizations. I know I've had that experience before. What I have done multiple times that I've been successful for my case is that I made those who once who had passion to become teachers. Your job is to teach, your job is to lead. Now, that means that you gotta take ego at times, because sometimes if you're really passionate, sometimes it kinda fuels the other thing, and you gotta check it at the door. Because if you're approaching someone and you're having that friction, they're not gonna learn from you. And they're gonna associate that subject with you, and they're gonna shut them all off. So take that knowledge and say, okay, you know, find a three, two, whatever number you feel comfortable with, and have make sure that, hey, let's go in here and pair together. Let's solve this problem. And it could be not, let's try that in a core, or let's try Angular 8, because it's out now. But it's more of that, let's solve this problem together, right? That's basically what pairing programming is without the double keyboards and whatever else. You're just sharing that knowledge and you're building each other up.
A lot of companies also have events they put on internal to their company where these people, as Javier says, are teachers. And once a month they have a thing where it's like, hey, we're going to teach you async await today. And they just kind of go through and do this on a regular basis. And that's what I would recommend. I'd recommend building a group inside of your organization that teaches the organization and have a monthly, we're going to learn something new. And make everybody have to attend that, and write reports after, you know, write something saying, hey.
Yeah, our sales engineers do a monthly dojos, but I think another thing
to be clear, the term that you just used was dojo.
Dojo, yeah.
Okay.
So every month they learn, somebody teaches something completely new, and they probably are learning it as they go. But I also think that to keep passion and to keep boosting people's passion has to do also with making everyone feel valued in your org, however that works for your org. Fastest way for me to bounce my behind out of a job was to have this feeling that really, literally nobody cares if I'm here or not. And thank God I'm in a job now where I actually feel valued. So,
this is really good advice. I think that it's important to remember that the people who have all of that passion are kind of overflowing with it, and better to have them overflowing and teaching other people and doing that. Otherwise, they might introduce technologies without, you know, or go rogue. I've seen issues like that where someone had so much passion that they introduced unsupported open source software or different things like that. But if you are enabling them to channel that energy in an appropriate way, then you're going to have a better team. Any questions in the back over here? I see a lot of people checking their email. No?
Oh, there's one back. A couple
question
back
over here. Yeah. Oh, I'll get you in just 1 second. I'm going to run all the way in the back, way over here, just like Donahue.
Ice cream is kicking in back there.
I had a question on what is the .NET Core adoption rate and the pace at which Microsoft is doing .NET Core, right? Probably might surpass the actual .NET framework, and what's going to happen in that case, because I might find features in .NET Core that may not be in .NET framework, so is Microsoft going to continue to upgrade the pace of .NET framework, or they're going to just abandon it and just .NET Core will be the model going forward?
That's a great question.
Kathleen pushes the mic to me. the way you should really think of these things is there's a term that Scott and I have been both talking about is something we call .NET Standard. And what .NET Standard is basically a contract of APIs that we're saying that all .NETs have to implement. So that's .NET Framework. That is .NET Core, and that is the Xamarin technology. And the reason we're doing this is called .NET Standard, and the reason we're doing this is because we want people to be able to take code from a Xamarin app and share it with a ASP.NET Core app, or share it with a .NET Framework app, or if you have an ASP.NET Core app, you can go grab code. So really, I don't think of .NET Framework as just an implementation of .NET, and it ships at a slower pace because it's actually part of Windows, so it ships probably about once a year, But it's not stopping. And so I almost answered the ASP.NET question, the .NET Core question over here the same way, saying there's no rush to move the .NET Core. You can .NET Framework's not going anywhere. It's not going away. We're still going to invest in it. And as we make .NET Standard the future, we will keep adding APIs to all the .NETs. And so what you're likely going to see is, because we can ship .NET Core faster, we'll experiment with .NET Core and put a new API in. And if people like it, we'll then move it to .NET Standard, and all the .NETs will get it. And that's how I think of that.
So I want to make sure that this is extremely clear, and a couple of other pieces are extremely clear to people, because I find it a little challenging for people to get this whole story. So for one thing, if I'm a programmer, is it kind of okay if I have a vision, not the technology, of the way .NET Standard is laid out to be, to kind of be a set of interfaces? Because that's kind of the way I like to think about it. And I understand that there's redirects and stuff that technical people have to worry about. But that pretty much lets me understand it at a very high level, doesn't it?
Right. The way I like to think of it is, it's a spec. HTML5 is a spec. It says all these things exist in HTML5. You can use these on any browser that implements that spec.
Okay.
And so .NET Standard is really, it's the future of where all the APIs in .NET will be spec'd. And so we'll experiment in maybe .NET Core or via a NuGet package. Once people say they like it, we can then bake it into the standard. And that's much better than what we've done in the past, where we put like a workflow one in, then we put a workflow two in, and we put multiple versions of these things in the .NET framework because we didn't get the first one right, so we had to put another one in. I'd much rather say that we have some way to experiment outside of the .NET standard. But really, what everybody should really care about in the future is what version of .NET standard are you targeting?
I think those.
So right now, just one more thing real quick. So right now, as we look at it, you have code assets today. You're asking about your code assets, okay? There's a tool you can go right now, as soon as you get home, you can go and download, and it's called the Windows Portability Analyzer. I got that name right, correct? Yeah. Okay, you can download the Windows Portability Analyzer. You can run it against your existing .NET assets. So you run it against those DLLs. You ask it what won't fit onto .NET Standard 2.0. That's the one you care about. And so if your application is completely consistent with .NET Standard 2.0, that means when it's fully baked and ready to go, you just say target that instead, and then you get kind of .NET Core for free. Now, this is all just playing out. And so today, .NET Standard 2.0 is not ready to go. But then if you have problems, you know right where they are, and you can contemplate what that means to your organization. So .NET Standard is something you can find out about today. You don't have to wait till it's out, because the Portability Analyzer will tell you about it right now.
But and the promise it's making is you can take your .NET framework code and move it into a Xamarin iOS app if you wanted to.
And so this isn't all the code. This is the library code. So rip out the web API stuff, rip out the some other stuff.
This is all it rips out all the things that are platform specific. So, you know, obviously WinForms is a Windows only technology for obvious reasons. WPF is a Windows only technology, so they're not in the spec.
So is ADO.NET in there?
ADO.NET will be in there, yes.
Okay. And well, in .NET Standard 2.0, it
yes.
will be in there.
Yes,
okay. And what about Entity Framework? Is that separate? Do we do that in a NuGet package?
Entity Framework today is a NuGet package.
Okay. So this kind of gives you just a couple of pieces to see that it's not just string. It's not just integer. It's real stuff that you can put down and run
If only people had seen my keynote.
70% of all the code in NuGet.org is .NET Standard 2 compliant today.
Did you hear that? It's all of NuGet.org. 70% is compliant today before anyone looked at it and thought about this at all.
Well, we did think about it a little bit. One thing I want to point out, though, that I'm hearing is a lot of people are getting all
I didn't mean it that way.
I know.
I meant the
hang on, Scott Hunter.
We as a team did think about it. We actually did scan NuGet.org trying to see if there was APIs we should put into the standard to have more of the stuff in NuGet actually be .NET Standard 2 compliant.
Okay, so that's part of how you got to this pretty high coverage right there.
Correct.
Okay, cool.
Cool.
And so isn't that cool? I mean, that means the whole package can move. That, you know, it's not 70% of the lines
people,
of code.
Kathleen, people need to not get wrapped up in version numbers. Yes, it is likely at the speed we're going, .NET Core 5 could happen before .NET Framework 5. But HTML 4 and 5 work on Edge, which is like IE 12 or something, or whatever version Edge is, I don't know. It's an evergreen browser. Chrome is on 60 or 70 or 80 or some version. People get all wrapped up in those version numbers. So there's a challenge to deal with is that, are we targeting Chrome 58, or are we targeting specific specifications within HTML? So I'm hearing you say, worry about these slower moving .NET standard ones. Don't get wrapped up in the fact that .NET Core might have a bigger number than the .NET full framework.
But also, I want to just end with one point, which is if you're a .NET framework customer, there is no rush for you to go move the .NET Core.
The
reasons to move the .NET Core today are you need cross-platform. Mm. If you're running your enterprise and you're on Windows Server and you're happy with all that, you don't have to do anything. .NET Framework's not going anywhere.
We got about 5 more minutes. Got a question right here.
Hi. So I have a 5-year-old and a 2-year-old, and I was just wondering if you guys had any recommendations for how to introduce them to development and technology.
I do. Well. What do you think, Jen?
So can I
promote a website?
Absolutely. Promote on. Let's make this our final question. All of us can answer.
Okay, very quickly. So I think that at that age group, and I'm a mom of two, so I've kind of seen this, I think that age group is really interested in making things, having something in their hand, and then making things happen to those things, whether it be throwing it against the wall or making LEDs light up. So what I would say is consider the maker movement your friend at this age. I've actually spun up a website called thinglearn.com. It's probably going to go down in a minute. But it has little projects that people can make with their kids, and it dives into the why and wherefore of IoT as deep as you want to go. But I have things like barrettes that light up and very girl-friendly things as well. So I look at the maker movement. This is going to get you where you need to go, I think. Jewel bots.
Yeah, jewel bots are great. Those are by Sarah Chips. They're little Arduinos on your wrist.
And I'm going to tell one real super quick story about my son, and then I'll give one more explanation. And I'll hand it off. So when my son was about 8 years old, this is back in the day when there were books, remember those? And like that actually came with computer stuff, VB3. We sat down and I taught him how to make the Microsoft Butterfly fly randomly around the screen and open its wings and open and close. And then in true 8-year-old fashion, he says, "Mom, that's really cool. Now how do we kill it?"
Nice.
And I said the wisest thing, one of the wisest things I ever said as a parent. I said, "Don't know, gotta go make dinner."
Nice.
So the other thing I'd say real quick is there's another site I'd like to talk about if you have kids that are interested in core ideas and algorithms. There's something called USICO, that's United States of America Computing Olympiad. They are the team that competes internationally in algorithms competitions. And if you didn't know you could compete in algorithms competitions, you can. And USICO has a site that is extremely designed for getting people into that. So it's usico.org, USACO.
So one of the things that I do back where I live is I actually volunteer to actually teach a programming class to the middle school that my kids go to today. And that's what I'd recommend. You'll find it's more than just your kids. A lot of kids are actually really interested in this stuff. And so we actually just put it in one of the flyers that they had at the school one day. And the next thing we know, we had 40 people signed up. So both women and boys, girls and boys, it was both. So I'd recommend volunteering to teach a class at your school.
So it's interesting because I have three boys. They're within the age of 6 and 11. So I have to teach them differently. I noticed that with my older, the maker approach works better. We actually have a Kano computer, which is a Raspberry Pi with keyboard and everything. It's a great little thing.
It's K-A-N-O.
K-A-N-O. He can build Minecraft, and he can customize it. He can program it. It's really great. So he loves that. For my 8-year-old, we are doing a lot of hopscotch and Scratch on the iPad. He actually airplays it on the computer, and he shows all of his brothers what he's building. So there's a little more of that. My youngest, we play the Turtles game that teaches you how to program.
Robot Turtles.
The Robot Turtles. Where you
board
can
game.
It's a board game. So it's essentially a board game, and you have to move turtles from across the board, and you essentially build instructions.
It's like Logo, but it's a board game.
Yes, take a left, take a right.
I was going to say, speaking of the iPads, Swift Playgrounds on the iPad is awesome as well.
Yeah.
It's a great and it starts with the same kind of thing, moving stuff around a grid.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. So it feels like you're kind of telling a robot what to do.
Try Code Combat as well. Code Combat.
So I was going to say Code Combat. So here's your notes.
Yep.
K-A-N-O
yep.
is a kit you can pick up at Toys R Us. It's a Raspberry Pi.
$100.
You can be a competitive algorithms person. You can teach at your local school. You can do
JoulBots.
JoulBots.
Kind of
JoulBots is great. Those are out of New York, and those are little Arduinos on your wrist, and you can have secret messages to each other. And then I got my son's a Piper, P-I-P-E-R, which is similar to K-A-N-O, except it is a computer that they build entirely out of wood. It has a Raspberry Pi inside, and it has scripted Minecraft adventures that you can actually download. And then they always have a physical component. So for example, you're trying to find a treasure, you're running around on this beach, you need to make a treasure locator, you gotta pull out the circuit board, plug it into the Raspberry Pi rather, and make it so when the Minecraft person walks in the virtual world, an actual LED lights up when he's walking over treasure. Fantastic tool. I would think it's like Kano on steroids for maybe an older kid. So a lot of great tips here from everybody. And thank you so much for coming on the panel. I appreciate you. It's Hanselman and Friends, everybody. definitely feel free to grab folks as they are in the hallway and talk to everyone here. Is very approachable and has all kinds of great advice for you. And I thank you all for joining me today.